Hi and welcome. This is Dave. How are you guys doing?
Pretty good.
Great.
Hi, Dave.
Hi. Let's start with wins and progress notes. What's going on for you?
Wins and progress notes.
Yeah. How are you finding the material, both the curriculum and the couple of seminars that we've had? Is it what you've expected?
It's great. I'm learning a lot. I'm sorry, were you asking one person in particular?
No, everybody.
Okay. I'm learning quite a bit. I've mentioned this before, but I really like the common sense logic, what with the, the different quotes from famous people that you use, and the just matter-of-fact explanations. It's so easy for me to retain and then reuse, when I try to explain it to others. I really like that.
Good. I hope the organizing metaphor of a story and a life story and various storylines is useful, and I thought that maybe the best way to do that would be to model that and talk about it in that way as we go through the seminars. So thanks for that comment. Olga, you were saying something in the back.
I'm really enjoying it. I love the idea, and I think I mentioned this the last time, of looking at our lives as stories. And the fact that we can change the old story is like not having to stay in the same chapter, but being able to revise our story. And what I like about this course, too, is that you're bringing in the psychology of change. And what I enjoyed about reading this was neurogenesis and neuroplasticity. And I said, well, it's never too late as long as we're creating a new experience, So I'm enjoying it. I think I'm learning a lot about change. I know that we cannot change anyone, and I think you've mentioned that in the text. And you just, a lot of reminders, and a lot of going back and saying, well, I remember when I was doing this. I remember how I was doing this. And sometimes I find myself doing the same thing. So it's helping me not only to help others, but personally as well. So,
great. Okay, super. Thank you for that. I think that's a really good way to approach it. And remember, we'll save some time at the beginning of each of the seminars to look at any challenges that you have, either in writing your own story, since this is confidential, or in any work that you have with clients. And to bring that in and to look at that, I think, can be helpful in terms of application. Because as I mentioned in the beginning, we don't do a coach the coach. The only thing that is required is to do the write-up according to the roadmap. And I gave you the sample of that earlier, and we'll schedule that as we go along for each of you to have a time to do a presentation of that on yourself or on a client. So we'll have plenty of time to discuss, and one of the things I love about a small class is there's more time to discuss material and cases so that each of you can have more of an experience of application, and we can brainstorm about various ways of applying and extending this in working with clients. How many of you are actively seeing clients now, and what generally is your client caseload?
I'm not seeing clients. This is Olga. I'm not seeing clients I'm working with groups of parents.
Okay.
And I think that it may be a group coaching situation.
Okay, well, that's having clients. Your client is the group.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're planning to continue to do group coaching?
I plan on doing group coaching, yes.
Okay.
And seminars and workshops, and that's where I'm heading. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Good morning.
You know, it might be helpful. What I mentioned in the beginning is that I'm going to send each of you as my compliments, my gift, the client workbook that is a separate product, a separate book. It might be helpful if I go ahead, rather than waiting until the end of the seminar series, to go ahead and get my fulfillment house to go ahead and send you that so that you'll have it to look at and to be thinking about how you might use it in groups. I think there's a particular usefulness of that in groups, and that 28-week protocol I've used that in working with coaching groups. I've used that in working with coaching groups of New Life Story and New Money Story Mentor coaches in coaching groups. So I know it works well with that. It can be expanded or contracted, or certain portions can be focused on. So I'll go ahead and get my Fulfillment House to send you the workbook. It should arrive within a few days. It takes them like 5 to 7 days to ship it.
That's the workbook that we'll be able to personalize?
Yes, exactly.
I'd be very excited. I'd be very excited to get that. I know I've got one. I don't really call them clients because I'm not really officially a life coach. Just the people that I consult for. I've got one in particular, a CEO of one of the companies, and I've already started talking to him about closing chapters on his life and beginning new chapters rather than constantly reflecting on the past, just to close it and start a new one. And, you know, just basically what he taught us in seminar one, and he is responding so well. And he's a rather stubborn type, and he has responded better to that than he's responded to anything I've ever done with him. So I'm excited for the workbook.
Great. Okay, super.
Yeah, me too. This is Shakuntala. I don't know if you know him.
Welcome. Hey, how are you?
Yes, I'm great. I'm great. It's nice to be with you guys. Yes, I'm really excited to receive the workbook. I'm really enjoying the material, although I'm still a little bit catching up. I haven't heard last week's seminar. I'm catching up a bit on my reading. I'm loving the work. I'm working with clients now currently. I'm working with a few clients. My intention is to do more work with seminars, and I'm working with another co-facilitator to create a spiritual life coaching workshop, like a month-long intensive. So that's what we're working on as well.
Terrific. That sounds great.
Yeah. And I'm interested in the group work, too, so that sounds awesome, the group coaching.
Okay. And if we want to spend a little bit of time talking about that, I'll be happy to send you some protocols that I have for groups that would be helpful to you. We'll designate a time when each of you are ready for that and spend a portion of the time talking about application in groups and some of the suggestions that I have for groups and some of the mailings that I do to groups in case that would be helpful to you.
Sounds
great. So we'll definitely keep that in mind.
Now, Dave, excuse me. Oh, this is Olga. You have mentioned the 28-day protocol.
Yes.
Is that somewhere where we can download that?
I sent you a link for that that I got from my IT guy when you requested that earlier today. And after I sent it to you, I went there and saw that it's only for the recording. So I have another request into him. It's the CTA IT guy to see where that was. It should have been the page that you were directed to when you signed up with CTA, that you could download the outline, the syllabus, the 28-day protocol, and it would have the recordings there to place when it happens.
Dave, what you sent to me, this is Amy, what you sent to me via email a week before last, it had all of the print-offs that you just discussed. I was able to print off all three of those different categories, but it doesn't have any access to previous recordings.
Okay. Okay. Then I will look up what I sent to you, because the one I sent to Olga has only the recordings. I mean, it should be all in one. So I'm sorry it's confusing. CTA is redoing their website, but I'll recapture that I sent to you and what I sent to Olga and send both of them to everybody. We'll have it all in one place. I didn't hear you.
Well, David.
There's kind of an echo. Would you say that again, please?
This is Shakuntala. I was just saying that I'll need that as well. Thank you.
Okay, yeah, I'll send it to everyone.
And then, David, I just have a quick question. Is the 28-day protocol also in the client workbook?
It's not. No, I developed that in response to some people who wanted a suggestion about how to structure using the workbook and fitting it into a particular protocol. And I took in what I had done with a couple of groups I did and an assignment for each of the weeks, you know, certain exercises and work pages for each of the weeks for 28 weeks. And it's just a suggestion. I really had wanted to avoid reducing it to any kind of structure like that or Procrustean bed, but I saw that it could be beneficial and that some people wanted it. It can be kind of a starting off point, a template that you can do your own adjustment and expand or contract to see what would be useful for your particular group.
Right.
I mean, you may have a group that only wants to do wellness coaching or a group only wanting to focus on career transition issues.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, that would determine that, and you would only, like I did a group for women financial professionals from a presentation I did, and they wanted to do a group coaching. And what we did then was the first three or four modules where we looked at the fundamentals of change and then added the money story. So that they had the fundamentals and the principles of how to orchestrate a change and to go through a transition and then applied to a money story. So that was some of the work they did, and then they discussed the exercises and work pages that they did in the group. So that's one way to do that, to combine the initial modules that has to do with the roadmap system with a particular area like career or money or wellness or something like that, you know, relationship even.
Thank you.
So any challenges that any of you have had or questions that you have about the material or the application or anything with any of the clients you're working with that would be helpful for all of us to talk about? If not, we can move right into the material, but I want to be sure that if it would be helpful to talk about any specifics or applications that we do that. Okay, well, let's move into the material then. Remember in last seminar, we talked about the first three steps: recognize authorship, own your story, assess the plot and storylines. And today we're going to be talking, beginning module two, with step four, decide what to change. So we'll be talking about choice architecture, especially about identity, choice, and the dynamics of mind and brain. And I think some aspects of knowing how our minds and brains operate will make us significantly better coaches. Now, a precept for this step, part of the struggle to get people to embrace change is because the methods to facilitate change are often contrary to how the mind and the brain work. And that's one of the reasons I think it's so important to understand these principles. And I want to spend some of our time today to do this. So a brief recap to set the stage for step four. Despite being presented with ample evidence of how change would be beneficial, many people don't make changes even when they know it's in their own best interest. And story is the narrative thread of our experience, not what literally happens, but what we make of what happens, what we tell ourselves and each other. This becomes what we remember. Wayne and Butch, my two best friends in high school, don't remember my senior prom, they remember theirs. The story tells most about the teller. You make your world fit into the story you're writing. Your story determines your future by predicting it. You write your story, then your story shapes you, determines your relationship with everything. Your present and future story is yours to write. So first, let's talk about identity. And again, if there are any questions or any clarification, interrupt me at any time. Your identity is not your behavior or your habits. A habit is not a definition. It's simply a choice that gets repeated. If you define yourself by what you do or by your habits, it will make it harder to change. Now, we listen to other people's stories, how they make up who they are, what they need, including from us, how they teach us to respond to them. People become the stories of who they think they are. These stories usually leave something out, from a blind spot even to the shadow side of what's wonderful. that something can become an abiding quest, a want or a need that can actually define. So remember the equation from last seminar. Belief drives behavior. Behavior drives performance. Here are a couple of examples of basic storylines that show how a belief can lead to behavior. A wish for approval or acceptance. It can lead to superachievement and benevolent acts, or it can lead to someone taking too many risks or refusing to take risks, or someone never saying no and promising too much. Another example, the need for harmony can power affiliation and social achievement. It can also make it difficult for people to stand up for themselves when they have a different opinion, or to disregard a need. Remember my client from last session who said yes to everyone else except himself and his self-care. So as we talk about choice now, for this step, decide what to change, we're going to add an equation. It captures the principle that you either create your reality or agree to it. And this is the equation. Event plus response equals outcome. Every outcome you experience in life is a result of how you respond to an event in your life. Achievement is an outcome. It's the result of responding in certain ways. It's not what happens to us, but our response to what happens to us that makes the difference. So if you don't like the outcomes you're experiencing, you have two possible things to focus on. The event or the response. If you focus on the event, you can blame the event. Well, I'm sorry I'm late. The traffic on I-10 was terrible. Or my personal favorite, the assembly instructions didn't make sense. Or you can focus on the response. You can change your response to the events to get the outcome you want. But to do that, you have to give up blaming and complaining. Now, once more, remember this essential principle for ownership of your life story. In adulthood, you either create or allow everything that happens to you. You worked out, so now you feel more energy and alertness. You didn't attend to marketing, and now your business is slumping. Choice is part of a mindset. The antithesis of choice is also a mindset with its own text. Here's how that sounds. Fate, luck, circumstance, bad traffic, things just happen. I don't think I can do it. The absence of the awareness of choice limits possibility. And here's a kind of a footnote. Whatever you're doing that you can't control is your addiction. You can be addicted to a substance, a person, a behavior, a process, a certain kind of relationship, or to compromised results. Have you noticed that people specialize? They keep having the same success or the same problems. If the success is with money and business startups, we see a serial entrepreneur. If the problem is with relationships, it keeps getting repeated. Catherine Ann Porter said, his mother rejected him. 1,000 women since have paid for that. And think about the paper, if you've had a chance to look at it, on attachment. We have a particular attachment pattern to people, to money, to work, to whatever we have. We have a set of standardized responses that we have that becomes part of our story. So it becomes very, very important to recognize what kind of attachment patterns we have as default ones to certain kinds of relationships and issues and processes. Now, here's another to consider. First for yourself, then you'll recognize it more easily when you hear it from a client. What you seek is camouflaged in what you fear. You say that a different way. Show me an obstacle and I'll show you a desire. For example, show me clutter and I'll show you blocked energy that releases desire, that desires release. We always create the outside to match the inside. So, in other words, rather than strategizing to overcome or avoid or defeat an obstacle, simply consider not creating it. It's not there until you create it. It is there when you create it, so consider you're using your energy to create something else instead. An example, a man says, well, I only fall for unavailable women, it seems. Well, they're unavailable because they already have partners or they're emotionally unavailable. Since he's afraid of women and intimacy, he needs an obstacle to be in place so he can allow himself awareness of his desire. So this becomes his attachment pattern. Now, there's a secret here. An obstacle is the unconscious mnemonic of desire. It reminds you of what you want, but it makes it safe to want if you're afraid. Here's a, I think, a vivid example. I saw a cartoon of a dog. In the first frame, it was straining at its leash, barking ferociously at a cat, as if to say, just let me at him. The next frame showed the cat. The cat was not too shabby. It looked really mean, was at least as big as the dog. All of a sudden, in the next frame, in the middle of a ferocious bark, the leash snapped. So the dog was totally free to go after the cat. He looked astonished, scared to death. He then ran back, grabbed the leash, tied a triple knot. Then he could again safely strain at the leash and bark his ferocious, just let me at him. So when you find yourself focusing on an obstacle, for example, I can't find time to exercise, reflect on the underlying desire. And here's the coaching principle. When you're ready to consider that you create the obstacle, you're also ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. Imagine what it would be like not to create your obstacles. So in this session, we're going to look at what's involved in deciding to change. And then in the next two sessions, we'll apply it to map changes and author new experiences. So first, let's consider how the brain opposes change. This is crucial to consider when we engage change. Both our minds and brains automatically resist change. Findings from the cognitive sciences can inform how to change a personal or a business story. So let's first look at how the brain opposes change and then use this information to facilitate success. And remember, when you feel one side of the brain and think on the other, you probably need a map. Since the brain has a mind of its own, I think we need to consider 10 principles of how our brains work. Each of these, I believe, will help you in guiding someone to write a new story. The mechanisms are sometimes a little complex, but the principles are so simple, they're almost elusive. 1. Change generates discomfort. Part of the reason for this resistance to change is due to a fact that's far more challenging than just getting someone to decide to do things differently. Any attempt to modify behavior and habits requires an actual rewiring of the brain. Activities that we've repeated that have become habits are hardwired into the brain. Neuronal pathways and neural networks, the highways and villages in our brain, have become etched by repeated habits to create efficient operation to make routine behaviors easy. We don't have to think about how we drive the same way to work each day. Because of this default mode, we can think about other things or listen to a book. This default mode is also very energy efficient because the brain is freed up to do other things. And the brain is amazingly adaptive. It's made routine behaviors energy efficient by creating hardwire and growing new neurons for that purpose. When these habits then are confronted and have to change, the basal ganglia in the midbrain where the automatic pilots are get disrupted. We feel discomfort. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking brain, has to get busy with more energy and attention to process thinking. So it's work to change. The natural inclination is to resist the stress of change and to preserve the default habit. That's hardwired into our brain. The brain naturally resists change because to hardwire behavior saves energy, so it opposes what's been adaptive from an evolutionary sense. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. The brain just doesn't know that yet, so our minds have to lead the way. Some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene behavior. Ray Kurzweil, one of the most intriguing authors I have ever read, said, "Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations that we can perform without thinking about them." I heard him in a presentation directly say that, and that's from his next to last book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. His last name is K-U-R-Z-D-W-E-I-L. His last book is called Creating a Mind. Number two way that the brain opposes change. Change creates dissonance. So couple this brain inclination to keep doing the same efficient routine with the mind's inclination to see what we expect to see. We see what we expect, what our radar has been coded for. We do this by screening information based on expectation as validation. In fact, when people don't see what they expect to see, the brain's error detection mechanism reads as if something's wrong. The brain has an innate capacity to detect what neuroscientists call errors, the differences between expectations and perceived actuality. It registers as a sense that something's not quite right. At times, it can be abrupt and explicit. Remember the experience, for example, of absentmindedly going to the refrigerator and getting a drink of milk to suddenly discover when you took a sip that it was orange juice? When this happened, neural firings disrupt the expected flow and use of brain energy. So this error detection signal that something is wrong when routine behavior changes means that we have to take this coupling into account when guiding and strategizing about change. That something doesn't feel comfortable in the beginning is not an indication to stop. You have to leave your comfort zone in order to change. Now, the good news here, the brain contains neural machinery in this medial frontal cortex to recognize and to correct errors, to optimize behavior. This means that these frontal neurons also become active after negative feedback or diminished reward. So it also responds to mistakes. This is great if we remember to discern whether it's a mistake or a neural response and printout to change itself. The third way the brain opposes change. The brain is a prediction machine. I want to do an exercise. If you have a pen, I want to give you some numbers. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, and 8. What's missing?
3.
Anyone?
3 and 6.
Okay. Anything else? Any other? Or maybe multiples of 3?
3, 6, and 9. Yes.
Okay. Now, consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head, informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. In fact, extrapolation has been called the most common mistake in investing, when we predict the future based on the past. J. Paul Getty said that there are 3 common elements, 3 key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, and find oil. So you can see how brain prediction of pattern is also the basis of many jokes, listing 2 things, and then a 3rd non sequitur, set up, payoff. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This makes it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns at times to make wise and balanced decisions. So we need to be sure we predict or envision the right things. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both are likely to backfire. Studies show 2 things. Threats work short-term, but draw attention away from work and back to the problem that created the behavior. And secondly, recognition for someone being on time actually raises anxiety and reinforces the neural patterns connected with lateness. which is really an application of the principle of quantum mechanics, that we get what we focus on. Focus aligns the energy field of the brain, and we get what we focus on. So focusing on something negative, even the avoidance of something negative, is still focusing on something negative and will bring about what we most don't want. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. In fact, being told what to do results in an innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. Now, this is something I think is really important to keep in mind as you're working with clients, and they're resistant and they just seem really stuck, is that's them doing their job description. They're doing the very best job they can of showing you exactly what it's like to be them. So don't take it personally. Put your ego in a blind trust. And know that they're frustrated too, and that this is the best indication of what's going on with them, so that you can both collaborate about how to understand that and how to move forward. 5, motivation is not essential. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And someone may not generate motivation until they actually set a goal. An action can generate its own motivation. Most of the professional athletes I've worked with and professional actors, they get up each morning or whenever they do it, according to their biorhythms, they'll work out at the gym every day. Not because they're motivated. Most of them are not motivated, but they do it because they know that they need to do that, because it's the thing to do in order to do what's next. Motivation is not essential, but a plan and sticking to it are. If we have time at the end, I'll show you an exercise that I do when I do live presentations to kind of illustrate this. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Anxiety or fear shifts someone into a survival mode that prevents fluid learning and understanding. The alarm signals of fear, anxiety, anger, or even just irritability and impatience can shanghai the attention of the frontal lobes, causing them to forfeit their optimum function. So, when emotions are triggered, these brain chemicals are released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. So this is why self-talk is limited. Change your thoughts to change your behavior may work until emotion gets activated. As soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. In fact, one of the philosophers of the 21st century said it very simply. Everybody's got a plan until he gets punched in the mouth. Now, that was Mike Tyson. I didn't say he was one of the great philosophers of the 21st century. So a classic study looked at the correlation of reward and dopamine response. We typically have thought in neuroscience for a long, long time, or in the sciences for a long time, that a reward of the chemical dopamine was a result, a consequence of behavior, and that's what reinforced the behavior. Well, that's not what happens. It's not the reward that causes the spike in dopamine. It's the anticipation of the reward. For example, people can be wired as they go up to a slot machine, and before they ever touch the machine, they get the spike of dopamine. It precedes ever touching the machine far before they were ever rewarded for a win. So that's why the anticipation of spending money, or the anticipation of making money, or the anticipation of something that can be addictive is the cue to trigger this. In fact, as some of you know, when I practiced psychiatry, I had one of the first 2 or 3 major eating disorder treatment programs in the country in the early and mid, throughout the 80s. And One of the things I came to learn and would ask each patient is at what point in using food, and let's say it was a bulimic, and she would be addicted to eating in a bulimic style, at what point in eating food or what point in the binge did your state change? Did you change the way that you felt? Inevitably, 100% of the people said, before the food ever touched my lips, same with alcohol, same with a drug. It's before it was ever ingested. And that's important to remember. And there are some implications of this that we'll talk about at a later point in terms of working with clients. So, in terms of how our brains work, 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as a little bit of stress, enhances memory and learning. The things that excite us and provide a little bit of stress short-term enhance learning. The time window on this phenomenon is about 2 hours. For longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. This means that with sustained stress, people make bad, emotionally charged decisions. The most important success strategy for our clients, I believe, is regulation of states of mind and management of emotion. Now, why is that important? Think about the implications. Here's an assortment of findings and their sources. Stress contributes to 85% of all medical problems, Cooper Wellness Program. 70 to 80% of physician visits are stress-related, U.S. Public Health Survey and the U.N. Council both. 52% of executives will die of diseases related to stress, Cooper Wellness. Stress is the number one reason behind sickness from work, G Publishing Survey. Stress undermines work productivity in 9 of 10 companies, Industrial Society Survey. And regulation of state of mind, we're going to devote an entire seminar, seminar 6, I think, and all of module 4 is devoted to states of mind. I think it's that important. 8, closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place, in one position, get most entrenched. And another place I see this resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 32 years ago to his 2 children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone has to engage change. They change roles, relationships, functions at work. Now, these last 2 principles, I think, are absolutely huge for coaching. 9, neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. 2 things above all others create neurogenesis, an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex brain structure. That's what we do with our clients, co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust, nudge. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory. Remember, it's where the unconscious lies because it's second in line to deal with the stimulus coming in. The amygdala sorts and then passes to the hippocampus that attaches meaning. So this is where the unconscious lies. And it's especially associated with creativity and memory more than any other component of the brain. Mice from an enriched environment have a 15% increase in their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases the number of cells in the hippocampus? Almost 100%. In the hippocampus that is the site of creativity and memory in the brain. And these studies in mice have been replicated in non-invasive ways in humans in London taxicab drivers and University of Hamburg medical students. Another related finding, chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. The number of cells in the hippocampus declines with sustained stress. 10. Neuroplasticity simply means that the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. For example, for stroke patients who have a dysfunctional arm, the traditional treatment was to put the arm in a sling to prevent further damage. But when the good arm is put in a sling so that they're forced to use the bad arm to do things like feeding and dressing, after 10 days, the patient regains significant use of an arm that otherwise would have hung useless. The brains of these individuals recruited nearby brain neurons to perform the functions of the damaged ones. Neuroplasticity. Another example, not only do zoning laws change in the brain, but the amount of cortical real estate that a body part claims can be changed depending on its use. For example, an expert braille reader has a significantly greater area for handling the finger reading braille than someone who doesn't. Same with classical guitarist. Now, the good news is we are not hardwired for life. With new experiences, new neuronal pathways and new neural networks are formed. New highways to new communities in your brain. So, how do we counter the brain resistance to change? First, we reframe the question. How can we best mentor coach someone? So here are some things, and this is also in your outline. Here are some things that neuroscience teaches us about mentor coaching. One, everyone has prior knowledge that affects how they hear and respond to new information. Existing knowledge is the beginning of new knowledge. It's where new learning starts, simply because it can't happen any other way. Two, the prior knowledge is physical, real, and persistent as a neuronal pathway in the brain. Neuronal networks are a physical fact. They can't be simply removed or overwritten in the brain by another fact. They do, though, atrophy with disuse as other networks take their place. But it's an inside job. A teacher can't simply present a better explanation and remove an existing neural network from the student's brain. Three, if we ignore reality, it will get in the way of new information and change. So as we mentor, coach, and co-create change, we have to start where the client is, not where we are. We can't provide the tools for solving problems before our client knows what the problems are. And this is why fixing often doesn't work. You can't just list the four areas that an idea is wrong and expect it's going to rearrange somebody's neural network. And whenever you suggest a way to do something to a client, if it doesn't fit with what they already know, their error detection mechanism is going to say, that's not right. Four, partly because it's complex and personal and partly because it's subjective reality, which is kind of saying the same thing, someone is not always aware of their prior knowledge. And since prior knowledge is concrete, an actual pathway in the brain, an anatomical reality in the brain, a mentor coach needs to begin with discovering prior knowledge and begin with the concrete. Specific examples help someone to become ready for concepts, abstractions, broad principles. So, here are some specific ways we can help our clients change their minds and brains. And this is reiteration and review in a way. One, begin where the client is. You have a better chance of connecting with the neuronal networks of your clients if you use concrete examples that they already know, their own experiences. No one can understand something that's unconnected, at least in some way, to existing knowledge. Two, help them learn more about what they already know. To mentor in any way, we have to begin with where someone is, their existing neuronal networks. A simple way to begin is for someone to describe their experience and ideas about whatever subject it is. Or if we want to ask what someone's belief is or get to that, a simple way is to say, well, yeah, but how do you really know? 3, highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks. Examples are natural talents, behaviors, patterns, things that work especially to encourage their practice. 4, don't focus on mistakes. Focus will enhance neuronal etching, so it should be on useful habits. 5, correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lie. Encourage the clients to develop their own metaphors, stories, and connections. Stories, analogies, and metaphors create maps. To set the stage, engage people to explore possibilities outside their expectations. People need to experience what it's like to view things differently. Remember Ben Fletcher's study at the University of Hertfordshire to engage volunteers to do things differently, to be conscious of choice, to act on it, and then to see and assess changes. 8, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations or connections. Here's the amazing paradox of the brain. While the brain pushes back like a 2-year-old against new or different information and patterns, remember it's an organ of homeostasis with tracks already laid down that we call habits, it also has an intrinsic desire to create novel situations. How does this work? When someone solves a problem or has an aha experience or an insight, adrenaline as well as dopamine is released. Someone has 3 different areas of their brain that light up with an aha experience that vaults them into a different state of mind that is more creative and synthetic and engaging of new ideas. So there's an intrinsic reward mechanism for insight, for thinking about things in different ways, for coming up with novel connections. And it sets up an immediate inclination for further creativity. So this is part of why we ask questions and co-create innovative ideas rather than providing answers or solutions for our clients. 9, you have to recognize and take ownership of your experience. You won't believe things to be different just because you're told or just because it's a theory. You have to act on it. When we write a new story and change our minds, we also change our brains. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that gave an upside-down image consistently 24 hours a day. They had to learn to adjust everything they did, up for down, down for up. Everything was reversed, so they had to very carefully think through everything they did, every movement, in order to reverse what they were seeing and do what was effective. Then they noticed at about day 25, something remarkable happened. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. They didn't have to anymore. Their brains had rewired. They had developed new neural pathways, so everything looked normal. Now, another group of those astronauts in the headgear were given a day off, a full day, 24 hours, out of the helmets at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point on to make the adjustments. Now, some things are not so simple behavior response like this, where one mistake or one reverting back will cause you to go back to square zero. Most things that we do habitually involve more complex behavior patterns and sequences. So we do something that reverts back to an old way of doing something. So the faster we notice it and then resume what we were doing, it doesn't cause you to revert back to day one and to have to start all over again. But you recognize the pattern and continue then with the change and the plan so that it ultimately becomes hardwired. And finally, 11, give attention to a new experience or a new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. What we do in coaching, in meeting weekly with our clients, offers smaller amounts of information consistently over time, increments of change. We shrink the change. We reduce it to be specific and timely and in a stepwise manner. This process yields better learning than a one-time intensive training unless there are follow-up programs. Think about how if you've ever done like an intensive retreat or a workshop or a seminar and then not had follow-up, and how excited you were at the end of it, you were going to do all these things, but then you got back home and then things kind of settled back in. The status quo began to reassert itself. It's kind of like a shipboard romance. It seemed like I can't speak from experience here, but so I'm told. It seems like a terrific, overwhelming experience at the time, but then all of a sudden you disembark, and you know the romance, the state of mind is gone, and there's not much to have the sustaining attention. So when you do things like this, like workshops or seminars or retreats, they will work best if you have ongoing programs, ongoing ways to sustain and further and develop that. For example, I have, and this is why I think it's helpful to do the mentor groups, that we have a quarterly mentor group and a white paper for continuing education and to continue the camaraderie with people who are doing various things, to look at best practices, to look at things that are going on for other people, to really stimulate. This is one of the programs I have is to help corporations develop an internal mentoring program. And I'll often do like a half-day or a full-day retreat and then complete the training by teleseminar. But then for the next year, we'll meet on a monthly basis and have a mentor group on a monthly basis with a specific topic, but also really continuing to integrate that process and make it real and something that's alive and working and adaptive for them. Here's an example of a kind of one-time experience and how that works. Some penguins who wanted to learn to fly got together and hired a motivational coach. They put together an all-day seminar, hired the coach for the entire time. They set SMART goals, visualized, wrote affirmations. They were very well informed about how to do this in a strategic coaching way. After a few hours, one of the penguins flew a short distance in the room. Then others were encouraged. Eventually, by the end of the day, they were each flying around the room. When the seminar was over, they left and walked home. You have to think about it. Change is a process, not an event. Okay, let's talk about questions or thoughts that any of you have about the material or anything about it that you'd like to talk about, or just even clarifications about any aspect of it.
You know, David, I have a question. When you were speaking earlier about the fact that threats don't necessarily work, incentives don't necessarily work, I was reading that, you know, reading, not that exactly, but, you know, this week reading in the notebook, and I'm trying to incorporate it into some advice I'm going to need to give on Friday. I've got a female head of business who has a personal assistant who is just an outstanding individual, just maybe one of the kindest, most honest, wonderful individual humans, and yet she continually makes mistakes as a personal assistant, and she should have probably been fired by now, but the woman, the head of business, continues to hold on because she sees such amazing potential. And I know that right now she's currently using an incentive program, and she's trying to like help her count the number of mistakes per day so that she can reward her if she only makes one mistake. And it's rather involved, and it's certainly nothing that she should probably continue. But I'm struggling to figure out what kind of advice to give her, since you're saying that neither threats or incentives work. Then what do you do with an amazing employee who's kind of also a problem employee?
Well, what the program that's set up now is going to ensure stress, because it is consistently throughout the day engaged in a negative focus. So that's guaranteed not to work, and her function is not going to improve. In fact, it may decline with that, because we get what we focus on, and there's a focus on mistakes. You're guaranteed to get mistakes. So,
right.
A different approach would be to look at what kinds of positive functioning that's expected, to look at helping that assistant establish her own goals and her own timetables for that, to look at it in a positive way, to make it her story. It's kind of like with an adolescent. As long as, you know, parents are watching over them, ready to, you know, talk about something negative, their only choice is to make something their own story is to screw up, to make a mistake. That's the only thing they can be. That's the only way they can be effective and be their own individual. Let me tell you a story about this. I think it will apply, and maybe from it we can get a principle of how to help your client who has the assistant?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. Many, many years ago, when I was practicing therapy and analysis, I saw a young man who came to me. He was 17 years old, and when I went to get him in the waiting room, all three, he and both of his parents stood up. And I managed to do a little cutting horse routine and wanted to meet with him first, since he was the designated patient, and indicated that if we decided, we would call and have them join us for the last few minutes. So we got back in the office, and he was kind of stunned that he had not seen something like that before. His parents actually had literally enrolled them in their Ivy League by the time he was 2 years old. They were both graduates of a very prestigious Ivy League, undergraduate and law, one law, one medical, and they had his course planned. They were a super achieving family, and truly the only way that he felt that he could be his own person was to make mistakes. So I said, what happened? Why are you here? He said, well, my parents required that I come. And I said, okay, you've met their requirement. Now, you're free to go, or if you'd like to stay and talk, I'd be very eager to hear what all you're up to and if I can be of any help to you, but that would have to be your decision entirely. In other words, from that point on, we cleaved the old story. This was now a new story, and if he was going to stay, it was going to be his choice and his story, and I was going to be his therapist. So we changed the framework immediately. And he said, well, okay, you know, and he's kind of with a nonchalant. He said, they finally made the call. He was at one of the two most, as you might guess, most prestigious private schools in Houston. He said, they made the call for me to see you when I got back an exam. I got 118 out of 120 wrong. And I looked at him and said, how did you screw up on the other two? And he knew exactly that I knew what he was doing, obviously. And he said, I messed up. I said, still, that's darn near perfect. You must have really known the material. He said, well, yeah, I did. So then he talked about how the only way he could really be his own person was to make mistakes, and we began to talk about that and what kind of situations and how difficult that was for him. And he decided he wanted to work with me. He was intrigued to work with me and to look at how he could be his own person with a very different framework than screwing up, because that was all that was focused on. So we agreed then to have his parents in the room for the last couple of minutes just to continue this process to say everything he and I talk about will be absolutely confidential, and I won't be saying anything to either of you. Your son has decided to do this work himself and make it his own story, and that's all that we decided together to tell you. Now, you know, it's up to him what he tells you, but I would strongly suggest to both of you to not ask him anything about this work, to talk about anything except this work, and to look at allowing him to do his own work in school, to make his own decisions, but that's just a recommendation. He'll take it from here because he knows how to address that now in a very different way. And we had a terrific work together. So that I think is an idea of how do you reframe this from the mistakes and somebody else's story and just being an extension of their story to how do you make it the personal assistant's own story to make her functioning her own story, because she has this list of stuff of how not to screw up and how to count mistakes. That's somebody else's story she's fitting into. She is not going to work well fitting into somebody else's story. So the question is, how can her boss help her make it her own story and it be her success, her achievement? Remember, the most basic desire that we have as human beings is to be effective, and to be effective at what one creates, at your own story. So she will have to determine what is effectiveness for her. If she has this, you know, huge list of all the ways to screw up and all the ways not, she knows how to write a story to do what's right. And I would say let her do it. And emphasize the positive and, you know, not treat her special in any way, because, you know, it's like the kid that ever squiggle is treated like a Picasso. They know that's not authentic. If you say, yay, you know, every time, you know, she schedules somebody and doesn't trip coming in the door to tell you, that's inauthentic. So she has to make her own story work for her within the functioning of what she needs to do. Does that way of thinking about it make sense to you?
It does, definitely. In fact, I think I will ask if I can just sit down with her, maybe without the boss, and try to structure it similarly to what you did with the young man. That might really get her attention, just to talk to her about her story. I do like that very much. Yeah,
now,
that's
her
great.
Boss
Thank
is
you.
Your client, though?
It is, but, you know, she's so fed up with the situation, and it's impacting her day-to-day life. I think she's happily pay to have me sit down with her personal assistant instead of her this round. I think she'd be a breath of fresh air if I could figure it out for her.
Then you will have to, you have a system that's still not working, and you will have to cleave the usual way that her boss intrudes into the system and makes it dysfunctional to suggest to her ways to respond and not to respond to the employee. You have to address the components of the system that are not working, because the assistant, you know, tries to do her stuff, but if the boss does the same thing, it's going to reinstate the old system pretty quickly.
I've watched that the personal assistant is trying very hard to meet this incentive program, because she actually gets time off if she does well on it. So when I suggest that we take it away and just start fresh, I wonder if I'll be met with any flack from the assistant, even though it's not working for her. You know, there's the thought that maybe someday it will and she'll get these days off, you know, that she's trying to earn. I wonder how I could just phrase that simply to let her know that it's better just without the incentive program.
Well, see what she wants to do. See what she wants to do and recognize the how it causes a focus on the negative and it ensures that you bring about what you don't want by having this. It doesn't mean you don't focus on the positive things.
Okay.
And you can focus on the positive without them being, if you really pay attention to this, have the positive things not be the absence of negative. that would be a way to ensure failure. I want to diet and lose weight. That's not positive. That sounds like it, but it's not. The negative is still being overweight and losing weight. It's not to attain a certain body configuration, or it's not something positive. So be sure you help her structure it so that it's not avoiding something negative. Because remember, the brain, the unconscious, does not know the difference between positive and negative. It's like the film on an old-style camera. You can have the image, or you can have the negative, or the print, or the negative, but it's the same image. So the unconscious is going to read the focus. And if the focus is negative, even though it's negative placed in the container of avoiding the negative to get to the positive, it's still going to focus on it, and you get what you focus on. So be sure she's focusing on the right thing, and she's structuring it in the right way, and be sure the boss only responds to the success and fits into the idea as well. Does that kind of make sense?
It does. It does a lot, yes. Thank you.
Great. Okay, yeah, great example. Yeah, because I think some variation of this we'll see regularly with our clients. I had an initial session today with the first time for a client that had a situation with an assistant and had the second instance of blowing up at her, and which jeopardized my executive's function because it was public and it was not exactly executive presence and a model for the rest of the corporation. So we looked at some of these very issues about the functioning and the negative functioning of the employee. So it's not an uncommon issue. So I think it's a great example. Thanks for bringing it up.
Thank you.
Yeah. Other thoughts or challenges or ideas?
I think this is Olga. I think one of the greatest challenges for me would probably be because I have no I'm not a medical doctor, is bringing up the reasons why. You know what I'm saying? Or how it functions.
I want to be sure, because you're not a, what did you say?
I'm not a physician. You know, I'm not a counselor. I don't have the science, the psychology background.
My thought is you don't need that, and even better, because you don't have to transition from the things that therapy and counseling do to get to coaching. You can just start right at coaching. So that's a benefit. You don't have to go through that whole transition. Now, as a coach, you have access to all the body of knowledge that you can synthesize and integrate into coaching. So it's not a matter of, having it or not having it. It's a matter of your presence, your confidence in the moment. Of being able to use it. Now, tell me your question.
Well, being prepared. I guess because I'm not a counselor, you're probably a very effective coach because you have that, because you are a doctor, you have your medical degree ready, so you have that information. It's so ingrained in you. So you're able to tell people, in the course of your conversations with them or given that information. Whereas me, I would probably, it's not part of who I am, so it would probably take a lot longer for me. And I think that's just a challenge, that I'm saying that would be one of my challenges. It's probably.
Okay, let me expand a little bit and get an idea when you say that I would have an easy time to tell people, to tell them what? What are you envisioning?
To inform them about, I guess that's for us, like the reasons these changes or the purposes. The principles of change, when you're talking to them. But I think in a coaching situation, you're not going to do that.
I don't do that.
That's only for my
I don't do that right? with my clients.
That's what I'm saying. I'm not going to do that. I'm thinking out loud now.
Okay, well, good. And that's helpful, because what I'm talking about is for us to know,
right,
to be able to use this information. You're not going to talk about the 10 principles of the way the brain avoids change.
But I'm not going to do that. But... to kind of like form and a...
I don't do that with my clients.
Okay. I'm just thinking out loud right now. Like,
okay.
Go ahead.
Please.
I'm sorry, not to interrupt, but I think it's very interesting. Is that Olga that I'm talking to right now?
Yes.
I think it's very interesting. Since having started this course a few weeks ago with you all, I am finding less and less desire to do my doctoral level psychology studies. I am finding so much more real world relevance in what we're doing here. And I'm a straight A student. I'll admit it. I got a B last week because I was so disinterested in the methods and research, methodology. It had so very little in that course that I could really help anyone with, and I've gained so much more just from these 3 weeks with you guys. And I know I'm not a medical doctor either, but, just being in a doctoral program, it's night and day difference from the valuable things we're learning here. That's just my opinion.
Just blame it on me and have the instructor call me.
No, I really appreciate the wealth of information that I'm getting. I do. I really do. But, I mean, I hear you talking, but I know now, I'm just thinking through.
Well, that's good. I think that's helpful.
Well, prepared. I mean, not prepared because I will be prepared. But as far as all the technical terms, all the psychological and neuroscience,
uh-huh.
And I'm not going to have that for them. You know what I'm saying? Not as well.
No, you will have that for them. You have that because you're getting it right now.
Right,
this is not something you're going to pass on to them. It's not something I pass on to my clients.
It's to prepare myself, better understand the situations and the process of change.
Let me tell you a story that I think will
okay.
that might be helpful. Many years ago, I worked with a regionally known artist who wanted to work with me because he wanted to quieten some of the demons in him, but he was also concerned. He was fearful, actually, that it would also quieten some of his creativity because he knew it was the same source and the same fire that created his abstract expressionism, which was his kind of art. Well, what he found, of course, was that when he did the work and quietened his demons, that he became free to be even more creative than he was ever before. So he became he went from a regionally known to an internationally known abstract expressionist with a huge reputation. Now, this is the story I wanted to say in that. He talked about his creative process in a very vivid way. He said, when I go to the canvas and emote, what it is that I'm in a zone, I'm in a state of mind that I have access to all of the 15 years of formal training that I did, from line drawing, anatomy, color, all that. But I don't think about that in any way. I just emote on the canvas in this state that I'm in. And the movements and the gestures and the strokes that I make, I don't think about, well, this means this or this color means this or this line means this. Now, after I've done it and I look at the painting, I can deconstruct it and say where it came from, that this was informed by human anatomy. This was informed by line drawing. This was informed by the geometric. But at the time I do it, it's not something I'm conscious of. Now, that's what I predict each of you will get to the place of just responding to your clients in a contingent conversation that will be helpful for them in that moment. In the conversation and the exchange that you're having. Now, if you were to step back, you might recognize that, yeah, that comment was informed by something that I know about the brain from neuroscience. Or that's something that I learned here. But at the time, it's something you're using, not something you're giving as information, not something you're referencing, but you're just using it to inform your conversation, to be in the flow, in the engagement with that client at that moment, with the client as point of reference, with their story and the evolution of that story as the mutual focus for both of you in that total immersion. Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense. And I like the terms, having access to the information, having access.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I like that. Thank you.
Yeah, well, that's a great question you ask and situation that you're describing. And I think it really is important at this time, because I know that this is a lot of information for all of you. And that's my dilemma. I'd rather have a true seminar and discussion all the time, but then there's so much information I want to convey to you in addition to what's in the curriculum. So I think it's really important, as you are, each of you bringing situations and questions and, challenges to, for us to discuss and to really have it come alive in that way. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
Well, we're out of time. We'll have to stop here. We'll pick up right
here. Excuse me. Quick question, Dave.
Uh-huh.
Quick question. On the recording of this, because it is so much information, are you sending the recordings to us, or are we to go somewhere to find them?
No, they're on that. They're on that page where the link where each of the recordings will be posted within the next 24 hours. It's CTA, so you can't download it like an MP3 download. I have that at MentorPath, but it's not on there. At CTA, you can do online playback. So there's a page. I'll send that around to each of you guys.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that means. So
that means you can go to that link, and you'll see the recording, and you can click on it to play. And you can do fast forward or backwards and all that.
It's actually empty. You sent the link to me 2 weeks ago when I asked you to, but when you click on it, it's empty. There's actually nothing listed there.
The CTA guy is gonna post those. Just hasn't yet. He should be on it on a timely basis. So I'll stay on top of that too.
Okay, so am I going somewhere to find it, or is it going to come?
I'm going to send each of you a link to both the downloads and to the online playback.
Oh, okay, got it. Okay.
I'll send that around within the next 24 hours.
Okay,
thanks very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Till next week.
Okay.
Bye now.
All right, bye-bye.
See you guys.